My name is Mag Salim. I'm an anti-racist, anti-war campaigner, and I'm the daughter of the late Haji Muhammad Salim, who was murdered in a neo-Nazi terrorist attack in Birmingham in 2013.
Now, this murder of your father, I mean, it's not really well known. Can you just tell us about the circumstances and who committed the murder?
Yes, of course. On April, basically on 29th of April 2013, it's going to be my father's 10-year anniversary this year of his murder. My elderly father was 82 years old at the time, and he was leaving the mosque in Birmingham in Small Heath. It's a mosque at the end of our street, which we went to as children, and my dad has been going to for most of his life. A walk he does every day, five times a day. On this particular night, on the 29th of April, he was coming home from the late night prayers, which are the Isha prayers, and he was walking home with his walking stick, and he was followed home. He was trailed by an SUV, a blacked out SUV, and then basically someone started following him as well, and he was basically stabbed to death from behind, and they were neo-Nazis from Ukraine. The media has reported it was a lone wolf, but we know for a fact there was more than one person that murdered my father that night. The police tried to play it down because my elderly father is a Muslim, and we're not used to seeing, apparently the media is not used to seeing Muslims being murdered by Nazis. Always it's the other way around when they portray Muslims in a negative way. So we didn't get as much press coverage, and I've been campaigning tirelessly for 10 years to get my father's death recognized in the media as an act of terrorism, because Pablo Lapshin was charged under terrorism laws. Yet to this day, a lot of people don't know about it. And I'm right now currently in Harrogate in Leeds at a teachers' conference talking about this because the anniversary is coming up, and I'm traveling around the country to highlight my dad's anniversary and to highlight the level of Islamophobia growing on our streets in the UK.
Well, I mean, from what you've just said, I mean, surely if this guy Pavlo Lapshin did have help, the police, this is essential that the police understand this. It's a bit too easy to say, oh, this is a lone wolf, and then they're not investigating the wider problem of what support he might have had.
Exactly. And Pablo shook the hands of the British ambassador before he came to the Small Heath, Birmingham. And where we live is a predominantly Muslim area. And for him to come to a Muslim area and to get a work placement there, and knowing his neo-Nazi history in Ukraine, where he's making open plan bombs in the forest, where he actually blew up his, he was making a chemical bomb in his flat, and he blew that up as well. So there was a long history of him being a neo-Nazi and being a big fan of Dynamo Kiev. And you know, they found folders on his laptop, ethnic cleansing folders. He was a big fan of Timothy McVeigh. He also looked at you know, even you know, the New Zealand terrorist who murdered 51 Muslims in 51 Muslims. He had Pablo Lapshin's name etched on his gun when he did that murder, because he had all the people he looked up to. So that's how far this type of hate goes, because the media never portrayed, they always portray Muslims in a biased fashion, and these attacks are never highlighted. So yeah, we definitely do believe there was more than one person who attacked him that night, and we had to push the police to investigate this properly, because they were going to go with a robbery. You know, always a robbery, but my dad doesn't carry anything in his pockets. So they had all these motives, but the motive of you know, an Islamophobic terrorist attack was never their option. We had to push the police to investigate this properly, and the amount of you know, the amount of rubbish they gave us was ridiculous. And how they treated us at the beginning, they were like, "We're going to tell you what this is," and we said, "No, we're going to tell you what this is." You know, they stormed into our house like, you know, we were uneducated and we can't speak English. But we're all educated, we're all graduates. We know how the British police force are known to be racist, and so we had to challenge them and get fight ourselves. And we control the media. We had to get the media to come because they were pushing a different narrative.
Well, there is a bit of a problem, it seems, with the police. In the, I mean, with the Nicola Bulli case a couple of months ago, there the police were saying, "Oh, we just think she fell into the water and drowned." Well, the family didn't believe that, and in fact, what started to happen was lots of the neighbours and people who lived in the village were having to do their own investigations for the Lancaster police. But anyway, you said something very interesting there, something about the ambassador. Now, surely someone who's just come over as a migrant from Ukraine is not going to be shaking the hands of the British ambassador. I mean, that sounds absurd.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we always have believed there's been a lot more to it, because, you know, we had the London riots not so long before. And maybe, you know, I don't know. I've always kind of thought this could have been a state organized attack or a colluded attack, because it's like, who how can we allow Nazis in the country without checking them under the counter-terrorism bill, which they do with Muslims, or the prevent, which criminalizes ordinary Muslims. How come he wasn't checked? How come he was allowed to come here on a work placement and live in a Muslim area, and right behind, like not far from where we lived? And the fact that he not only murdered my father, like he butchered my father in the streets, and then he won a 3-month bombing campaign in Warsaw, Wolverhampton and Tipton, and put bombs outside 3 mosques. And this was one of the biggest acts of terrorism towards Muslims in the UK. And yet today I've had to fight to get it into the media. When I spoke to a major British broadcasting house, I had to argue with them to give the right information about my father's murder. And all they kept doing, you know, those typical negative stereotypes. Oh, was he like an Al-Qaeda type of attack? No, it was a neo-Nazi terrorist attack. And they always get the facts and the information incorrect. And whenever my father's death is mentioned in the media, it's never with the correct information. It was an act of terrorism, and they should call it a far-right attack. No, it's a far-right terrorist attack. Yeah. Let's get the word terrorist
You've just said something else. It's almost like every answer you're giving me, Maz, there's another bombshell in it. You saying he was committing other terrorist attacks? Was that before he attacked your father?
Yeah. In Ukraine, there was a Ukrainian journalist who contacted me, who was actually giving me some information. And, you know, it's from a place called Dnipritov. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. But he basically was making open plan bombs in the forest. He also, his neighbors said he was making some chemical experiments. He's a very, very clever PhD student. And also, Tony, I need to tell you, while he has been in prison in the UK, because he's been moved from Belmarsh to another prison, and they don't always keep us informed, so I have to push for them to know, he basically tried to make a chemical bomb in the prison, and he tried to blow up his prison cell, which they failed to highlight in the media. And I've had to find this information out from someone in that prison who gave me this information discreetly, and then I've had to contact the victim support and then get them to get their seniors to contact me, and then I had to push that story into the media.
Now, did you manage to figure out what was his motive? I mean, obviously the guy is neo-Nazi, but can we get inside the head of this guy? I know it's not a very nice thing for you to have to do, but to think, what is the motive there? What is actually driving him? Because he does sound like some sort of actually psychologically deranged maniac, as you've said, a neo-Nazi. But what drives these people?
Well, he in his police interview, he said he wanted to create a race war. But this is like in a country that you know nothing about. So, you know, the fact that, you know, the planning that must have gone in his head, he's a very clever student. He was very, he's done well in all his studies. That's why he apparently got this work placement. So his mind, he obviously has a lot of hatred towards Muslims. This is why he targeted Muslims in Birmingham. I mean, why he chose Birmingham in particularly is like, you know, and I was, you know, I've been looking at this for the past 10 years, and I know the far right here work with the far right in Europe. Mm. So, you know, we had the Football Lads Alliance here, which did a 10,000 mobilization a few years ago here in the city in London. And that was very scary. It was all beefy white men marching, and they have a lot of contact with Nazis in Europe. Mm. So we know this could have been, they could have all been working together, because how would they know? How would he know these 3 mosques, these locations? Why did he choose those mosques in particularly? How did he know his way round Birmingham?
Yeah,
You know,
you felt,
and again, he could not have done this by himself.
No.
There's a lot of planning gone into this,
but, I mean,
and I'm sure he's working with Nazis in this country.
Well, we think of Nazis as being anti-Jewish, don't we? But it seems that they're now spreading their wings to become anti-other sorts of religions. What's going on?
Yeah. Basically, have you seen the media? Have you seen the, you know, recently you've seen Suella Braverman's xenophobic campaign of hatred? You know, we're seeing the government's legitimization of Islamophobia spilling onto our streets. You know, we have government policies such as the not so independent review of Prevent, the refugees to Rwanda, and anti-refugee rhetoric around refugees on boats. And they're all Islamophobia by proxy, and they're emboldened by Islamophobes. And here, you know, Islamophobia is so rife on our streets. We've just had some elderly Muslims, two elderly Muslim men leaving the mosque, exactly like my father, 82 years old, one in London and one in Birmingham, and they were followed and they were set on fire, and they're still recovering in the hospital. And then another elderly uncle, Pakistani uncle in Birmingham, again similar to my dad, just last week, was followed from the mosque after, because it's Ramadan now, and after the late night prayers he was walking home, and three white men in a blacked out jeep, and they came up behind him and they kicked him in the back of his head, and he smashed his face forward into a shop shutter, and he's recovering, and they've been caught now, and that was a racist Islamophobic attack. They've been arrested. The other two elderly men that were set on fire, the motive is still yet to be released.
Amazing. Shocking, really. Anyway, what can people do, do you think? How can we, I mean, obviously we're talking about this now, but ultimately what's the solution, do you think?
The solution is we need to challenge this current government. It's extremely toxic. We need to demand people. We need mosques. We need mosques as well, and communities and leaders to actively put a stop to it. You know, our mosque and our imams must get politically organized to challenge these policies as well, you know, that the government are pushing forward. We need Muslims to demand from the MPs and ask Rishi Sunak at PMQs what the government will do about the increasing attacks on Muslims in public. We need to get on our streets. We need to challenge, and we need to fight this, because it's getting worse and worse. And the agenda right now with the government is extremely toxic. I don't know if you've seen Suella Braverman's blaming grooming on Pakistani men. And can you imagine, she wants to create a race war in this country, because right now,
well, I mean, the thing is, for a start, that's not true. I mean, there's just a case in Wolverhampton of a grooming gang, including I think it was three or four women who were all white. So this isn't just a Pakistani phenomenon at all.
It's that hoax, it's that disgusting narrative that they always use. You know, let's demonize a community, when we know very well 82% of groomers are white. And that's if you look at professors that have done reports, they've investigated this properly. So we know this is, again, it's a demonization of refugees, migrants, and a community that has provided such they've come here and they've worked very hard, and to demonize them in that way is absolutely disgusting. Because right now, if you see the hotels where refugees are staying at, the far right are growing, and they're outside those hotels and they're terrorizing them, and they're calling them rapists, they're calling them disgusting words, and you know, it's really, really toxic, and they're growing every day.
But
so we need to get out there and challenge it.
There is obviously a lot more Ukrainians coming over to the UK, and there is a neo-Nazi movement, whatever the BBC say, over in Ukraine. I mean, for example, you talked about this Prevent program. I mean, it is supposed to be aimed at Muslims, but for example, the Manchester bomber, somebody at MI5 decided that it wasn't appropriate to put him on the program. So you do wonder whether this is a kind of bullying tactic, and actually anybody that really is about to commit a terrorist attack doesn't even get put on this program.
Well, if you look at the Prevent policy, and if you look at the attacks in the UK specifically, in England, there's more far-right attacks And under prevent as well, there'd be more far right attacks than actually attacks by so-called Islamists. So this it's incorrect. The prevent policy is to criminalize ordinary Muslims. It's to make your teachers spy on you when they're there to teach. It's to make your neighbors watch you, watch what you're doing. It's putting paranoia into people to see anyone with a beard, anyone that looks visible Muslim, keep an eye on them, see what they're up to. They get, you know, and you know, this see say salty adverts on the tube. You know, it's targeting like brown and black people, not white people.
No. Do you think there's been any kind of positive outcomes from it? It must be very difficult, obviously, to lose your dad in that way.
Oh, it's been absolutely exhausting. You know, I'm still campaigning tirelessly after 10 years to get the government to recognize my father's death as an act of terrorism when Pablo was charged in the terrorism laws. And then also, again, you know, fighting to get an Islamophobia definition so we can recognize these attacks in the UK. I've only recently heard that they've accepted the APP, the all party parliamentary group's definition of Islamophobia, which is something, Not that it's going to make a big difference, because there's Islamophobia rife in the Tory party and within the Labour party as well. So, you know, right now, the only positive thing I can say is that, you know, I'm still going. I will campaign continuously. But there's actually, overall, to sum it up, it's good that I can say people are mobilising, they're waking up, our communities are waking up, they're doing a lot more. That's the best thing, because before they were actively sitting at home watching TV and not getting on the streets. And I think now, because it's affecting them, because it's on our doorsteps now, elderly Muslim men being burnt, being attacked on our streets, I think people are now starting to mobilise, now understanding that this is a dangerous situation, this is very dangerous, but what the narrative the government is pushing today. So that's a positive thing, is people are starting to mass mobilise.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've noticed is that many of the recent terrorist attacks, particularly the ones in 2017, the Westminster Bridge, the London Bridge attack, the Manchester attack, is that the people that conducted those attacks had all been reported to the MI5 terrorist hotline. So you do wonder, and I think maybe a message, an important message to get out there, is that if you do see someone who you think is suspicious, actually, you know, when I say suspicious, what I mean is somebody who has these kind of racist far-right tendencies, is not to bother with phoning up that hotline, but to just literally get in touch with your local police and flag it up to your local press, and maybe the police first, and if the police don't act anything, then talk to the press. Because in Bristol, I know we had a guy who was a Muslim convert a few years ago, who actually was reported to the police by his local mosque, and then arrested and tried, and is still doing time for trying to create bombs in his home. So actually, I think, you know, just talking to your ordinary local cops is probably going to be better. I wonder if you'd agree, Maz, with them phoning one of these hotlines.
No, of course not. I wouldn't call these hotlines. These hotlines, they're like I think they source the people. Like, I don't know. I don't trust them. I don't trust anything to do with the government and their hotlines, because I don't think it's doing anything positive today. I think if you see something, my thing would be, yes, go directly to the police station. Of course, report it, but don't be calling these hotlines, because I just find it too. I just don't trust them. I don't trust the government, and I don't trust the police either.
Okay, Maz Salim, whereabouts can people follow your work?
You can follow my work. I've got a page called Education for Peace on Facebook in remembrance of Mohammed Salim. So you can see my work on Facebook and on Twitter as well. I am Mohammed Salim is the Twitter handle, at I am Mohammed Salim.
Okay, Maz Salim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.